This installment of the award-winning, critically acclaimed Radio Tales series is brought to you by Generations Radio Theater. More information about this series is available at our official website at www.radiotales.com. This is a Generations production. The ocean sometimes calls the bold of heart to embark upon fantastic adventures. Voyages that forever change their point of view. But for a journeyman doctor, that change is about to become quite literal. As he looks upon an exotic world from an extraordinary new perspective. Gulliver's Travels, on this installment of Tales by the Masters. Gulliver's Travels by Jonathan Swift. Adapted for this series by Winnie Waldron. Part 2. Performed by Winifred Phillips.
Over against this temple, on the other side of the great highway, at 20-foot distance, there was a turret at least 5 foot high. Here, the Emperor of the Little People ascended with many principal lords of his court to have an opportunity of viewing Gulliver, as he was told, for he could not see them. It was reckoned that above 100,000 inhabitants came out of the town upon the same errand, and in spite of the guards, there could be no fewer than 10,000 at several times, who mounted upon Gulliver's body by the help of ladders. But a proclamation was soon issued to forbid it, upon pain of death. When the workmen found it was impossible for Gulliver to break loose, they cut all of the strings that bound him. Whereupon Gulliver rose up, with as melancholy a disposition as ever he had in his life. But the noise and astonishment of the people at seeing Gulliver rise and walk are not to be expressed. The chains that held his left leg were about 2 yards long, and gave him not only the liberty of walking backwards and forwards in a semicircle, but being fixed within 4 inches of the gate allowed him to creep in and lie at his full length in the temple. When Gulliver found himself on his feet, he looked about. He had never beheld a more entertaining prospect. The country round appeared like a continued garden, and the enclosed fields, which were generally 40 foot square, resembled so many beds of flowers. These fields were intermingled with woods, and the tallest trees, as Gulliver could judge, appeared to be 7 foot high. He viewed the town on his left, which looked like the painted scene of a city in a theater. He had been for some hours extremely pressed by the necessities of nature, which was no wonder, it being almost 2 days since he had last unburdened himself. He was under great difficulties between urgency and shame. The best expedient he could think on was to creep into his house, which he accordingly did. And shutting the gate after him, he went as far as the length of his chain would suffer, and discharged his body of that uneasy load. but this was the only time Gulliver was ever guilty of so uncleanly an action. For which we cannot but hope the candid reader will give some allowance, after he hath maturely and impartially considered Gulliver's case, and the distress he was in. From this time his constant practice was, as soon as he rose, to perform that business in the open air, at the full extent of his chain, and due care was taken every morning before company came that the offensive matter should be carried off in wheelbarrows by two servants appointed for that purpose. We would not have dwelt so long upon a circumstance that perhaps at first sight may appear not very momentous, if we had not thought it necessary to justify Gulliver's character, in point of cleanliness to the world, which we are told some of Gulliver's maligners have been pleased, upon this and other occasions, to call in question. When this adventure was at an end, Gulliver came back out of his house, having occasion for fresh air. The Emperor was already descended from the tower, and advancing on horseback toward Gulliver, which had like to have cost the Emperor dear, for the beast, though well trained, yet wholly unused to such a sight, which appeared as if a mountain moved before him, reared up on his hinder feet. But that prince, who is an excellent horseman, kept his seat, till his attendants ran in and held the bridle, while his master had time to dismount. When the Emperor alighted, he surveyed Gulliver round with great admiration, but kept without the length of Gulliver's chain. He ordered his cooks and butlers, who were already prepared, to give Gulliver victuals and drink, which they pushed forward on wheeled vehicles until Gulliver could reach them. He took these vehicles and soon emptied them all. 20 of them were filled with meat, and 10 with liquor. Each of the former afforded him 2 or 3 good mouthfuls, and he emptied the liquor of 10 vessels, which was contained in earthen vials, into one vehicle, drinking it off at a draught. And so he did with the rest. The Empress, and young princes of the blood of both sexes, attended by many ladies, sat at some distance in their chairs, but upon the accident that happened to the Emperor's horse, they alighted and came near his person, which we shall now describe. The Emperor is taller, by almost the breadth of one of our fingernails, than any in his court, which alone is enough to strike an awe into the beholders. His features are strong and masculine, with an Austrian lip and arched nose, his complexion olive, his countenance erect, his body and limbs well proportioned, all his motions graceful, and his deportment majestic. He was then past his prime, being 28 years and 3/4 old, of which he had reigned about 7, in great felicity, and generally victorious. For the better convenience of beholding him, Gulliver lay on his side, so that his face was parallel to the Emperor's, who stood but 3 yards off. The dress of the Emperor was very plain and simple, and the fashion of it between the Asiatic and the European, but he had on his head a light helmet of gold, adorned with jewels, and a plume on the crest. He held his sword drawn in his hand, to defend himself, if Gulliver should happen to break loose. It was almost 3 inches long. The hilt and scabbard were gold, enriched with diamonds. His voice was shrill, but very clear and articulate, and Gulliver could distinctly hear it when he stood up. The ladies and courtiers were all most magnificently clad, so that the spot they stood upon seemed to resemble a petticoat spread on the ground, embroidered with figures of gold and silver. His Imperial Majesty spoke often to Gulliver, who returned answers, but neither of them could understand a syllable. There were several of His Majesty's priests and lawyers present, as Gulliver judged by their habits, who were commanded to address themselves. Gulliver spoke to them in as many languages as he had the least smattering of, which were High and Low Dutch, Latin, French, Spanish, and Italian, but all to no purpose. After about 2 hours, the court retired, and Gulliver was left with a strong guard to prevent the impertinence and possibly the malice of the rabble, who were very impatient to crowd upon Gulliver as near as they durst, and some of them had the impudence to shoot their arrows at him as he sat on the ground by the door of his house, whereof one very narrowly missed his left eye. But the colonel ordered 6 of the ringleaders to be seized, and thought no punishment so proper as to deliver them bound into Gulliver's hands, which some of his soldiers accordingly did, pushing them forward with the butt ends of their pikes into Gulliver's reach. He took them all in his right hand, put 5 of them into his coat pocket, and as to the 6th, he made a countenance as if he would eat him alive. The poor man squalled terribly, and the colonel and his officers were in much pain, especially when they saw Gulliver take out his penknife. But he soon put them out of fear, for, looking mildly and immediately cutting the strings he was bound with, Gulliver set him gently on the ground, and away he ran. Gulliver treated the rest in the same manner, taking them one by one out of his pocket, and he observed both the soldiers and people were highly obliged at this mark of Gulliver's clemency, which was represented very much to Gulliver's advantage at court. Towards night, he got with some difficulty into his house, where he lay on the ground, and continued to do so about a fortnight, during which time the emperor gave orders to have a bed prepared for him. 600 beds of the common measure were brought in carriages, and worked up in Gulliver's house. 150 of the beds sewn together made up the breadth and length, and these were 4 double, which, however, kept Gulliver but very indifferently from the hardness of the floor that was of smooth stone. By the same computation, they provided Gulliver with sheets, blankets, and coverlets, tolerable enough for one who had been so long inured to hardships as Gulliver. As the news of Gulliver's arrival spread throughout the kingdom, it brought prodigious numbers of rich, idle, and curious people to see him, so that the villages were almost emptied, and great neglect of tillage and household affairs must have ensued, if His Imperial Majesty had not provided by several proclamations and orders of state against the inconveniency. He directed that those who had already beheld Gulliver should return home, and not presume to come within 50 yards of Gulliver's house without license from court, whereby the secretaries of state got considerable fees.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, the Emperor held frequent councils to debate what course should be taken with Gulliver, who was afterwards assured by a particular friend, a person of great quality, who was looked upon to be as much in the secret as any, that the court was under many difficulties concerning Gulliver. They apprehended him breaking loose, that his diet would be very expensive and might cause a famine. Sometimes they determined to starve Gulliver, or at least shoot him in the face and hands with poisoned arrows, which would soon dispatch him. But then they considered that the stench of so large a carcass might produce a plague in the metropolis, and probably spread through the whole kingdom. In the midst of these consultations, several officers of the army went to the door of the great council chamber, and two of them being admitted, gave an account of Gulliver's behavior to the six criminals above mentioned, which made so favorable an impression in the breast of His Majesty and the whole board in Gulliver's behalf, that an imperial commission was issued out, obliging all the villages 900 yards around the city to deliver in every morning 6 beeves, 40 sheep, and other victuals for Gulliver's sustenance, together with a proportionable quantity of bread and wine and other liquors, for the due payment of which His Majesty gave assignments upon his treasury. It was likewise ordered that 6 of His Majesty's greatest scholars should be employed to instruct him in their language. And lastly, that the Emperor's horses and those of the nobility and troops of guards should be frequently exercised in Gulliver's sight, to accustom themselves to him. All these orders were duly put in execution, and in about 3 weeks Gulliver made a great progress in learning their language, during which time the Emperor frequently honored him with visits, and was pleased to assist his masters in teaching him. They began already to converse together in some sort, and the first words he learned were to express his desire that His Majesty would please to give Gulliver his liberty, which he every day repeated on his knees. His Majesty finally agreed, when Gulliver swore solemnly not to depart from His Majesty's dominions without his license under the Great Seal. Gulliver was also required to execute alumos kelmen peso desmar lanimposo, that is, to swear a peace with His Majesty and his kingdom. And as a condition of his liberty, he was compelled to perform certain tasks, not the least of which being the protection of the kingdom against its enemies in the island of Blefuscu, and of the destruction of the fleet, which was now preparing to invade. The Empire of Blefuscu is an island situated to the north-northeast side of Lilliput, from whence it is parted only by a channel of 800 yards wide. Gulliver had not yet seen it, and upon this notice of an intended invasion, he avoided appearing on that side of the coast, for fear of being discovered by some of the enemy's ships, who had received no intelligence of him, all intercourse between the two empires having been strictly forbidden during the war, upon pain of death, and an embargo laid by the Emperor upon all vessels whatsoever. Thank you. Gulliver communicated to His Majesty a project he had formed of seizing the enemy's whole fleet, which, as their scouts assured them, lay at anchor in the harbor ready to sail with the first fair wind. Gulliver consulted the most experienced seamen upon the depth of the channel, which they had often plumbed, who told him that in the middle at high water it was 70 glumgluffs deep, which is about 6 foot of European measure, and the rest of it 50 glumgluffs at most. Gulliver walked toward the northeast coast over against Blefuscu, and lying down behind a hillock, took out his small pocket perspective glass and viewed the enemy's fleet at anchor, consisting of about 50 men of war and a great number of transports. He then came back to his house and gave order, for which he had a warrant, for a great quantity of the strongest cable and bars of iron. The cable was about as thick as a pack thread, and the bars of the length and size of a knitting needle. Gulliver trebled the cable to make it stronger, and for the same reason he twisted 3 of the iron bars together, binding the extremities into a hook. Having thus fixed 50 hooks to as many cables, he went back to the northeast coast, and, putting off his coat, shoes, and stockings, walked into the sea in his leathern jerkin, about 30 minutes before high water. He waded with what haste he could, and swam in the middle about 30 yards till he felt ground. He arrived at the fleet in less than 30 minutes. The enemy was so frightened when they saw him that they leaped out of their ships and swam to shore, where there could be no fewer than 30,000 souls. Gulliver then took his tackling, and fastening a hook to the hole at the prow of each, he tied all the cords together at the end. While he was thus employed, the enemy discharged several thousand arrows, many of which stuck in his hands and face, and besides the excessive smart, gave him much disturbance in his work. His greatest apprehension was for his eyes, which he should have infallibly lost if he had not suddenly thought of an expedient. He kept, among other little necessaries, a pair of spectacles in a pocket. These he took out and fastened as strongly as he could upon his nose, and thus armed, went on boldly with his work, in spite of the enemy's arrows, many of which struck against the glasses of his spectacles, but without any other effect further than a little to decompose them. Gulliver had now fastened all the hooks, and taking the knot in his hand, began to pull. But not a ship would stir, for they were all too fast held by their anchors, so that the boldest part of his enterprise remained. He therefore let go of the cord, and leaving the hooks fixed to the ships, he resolutely cut with his knife the cables that fastened the anchors. Receiving above 200 shots in his face and hands, then he took up the knotted end of the cables to which his hooks were tied, and with great ease drew 50 of the enemy's largest men of war after him. Thank you. The Blefuscudians, who had not the least imagination of what Gulliver intended, were at first confounded with astonishment. They had not seen Gulliver cut the cables, and thought his design was only to let the ships run adrift, or fall afoul of each other. But when they perceived the whole fleet moving in order, and saw Gulliver pulling at the end, they set up such a scream of grief and despair that it is almost impossible to describe or conceive. When Gulliver had got out of danger, he stopped a while to pick out the arrows that stuck in his hands and face, and rubbed on some of the same ointment that was given him at his first arrival. Then he took off his spectacles, and waiting about an hour, till the tide was a little fallen, he waded through the middle with his cargo, and arrived safe at the royal port of Lilliput. The emperor and his whole court stood on the shore, expecting the issue of this great adventure. They saw the ships move forward in a large half moon, but could not discern Gulliver, who was up to his breast in water. When he advanced to the middle of the channel, they were yet in more pain because he was underwater up to his neck. The emperor concluded him to be drowned, and that the enemy's fleet was approaching in a hostile manner. But he was soon eased of his fears, for the channel growing shallower every step Gulliver made, he came in a short time within hearing, and holding up the end of the cable by which the fleet was fastened, he cried in a loud voice, "Long live the mightiest emperor of Lilliput!" This great prince received Gulliver at his landing, and created him a Nardak upon the spot, which is the highest title of honor among them.
Gulliver's Travels was written by Jonathan Swift and adapted for this series by Winnie Waldron. The musical score was written and performed by Winifred Phillips. Titles and credit narration were performed by Winnie Waldron, the director of this program. The Tales series is produced by Generations Radio Theater, which is solely responsible for its content. Phonograph and music underscore copyright W.P. Phillips. All rights reserved.